versus Ramsey County and the Minnesota State Retirement System. We are proceeding with oral argument on Zoom today. The same procedural rules apply to our Zoom oral arguments as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Council will each have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. I'll just remind you that the oral argument is being recorded and no additional recordings of this oral argument are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. One other logistic thing, hopefully you can see the time clock in the grid view. If there's any technology issue, the marshal will stop the clock and we'll make sure you get your full amount of time. And then I'll just ask that each attorney introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Michelle Weinberg here on behalf of appellant Ramsey County. This case is about simply the enforcement of a mandatory grievance arbitration provision contained in a collective bargaining agreement. Because arbitration is mandatory to resolve any dispute over the interpretation or application of a term or condition contained in the bargaining agreement that is applicable to Ms. Shaber's employment with the county, the district court is the wrong forum. The district court has no subject matter jurisdiction over Ms. Shaber's claims against the county, and her complaint should be dismissed. Respondent Shaber brought 2 claims against the county: breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty. Underlying both of these claims is a complaint that the county had failed to pay Ms. Shaber the employer match to her deferred compensation account. At the outset, I'd like to highlight some facts relevant to the question of the court's subject matter jurisdiction, which are undisputed in this case. Of course, undisputed that respondent Allison Shaber is a deputy sheriff employed by Ramsey County and a member of a union, the Ramsey County Deputy Federation. That union's relationship with the county, and therefore Ms. Shaber's employment relationship, is subject to a collective bargaining agreement. The collective bargaining agreement contains, in Article 7, mandatory grievance arbitration processes to resolve a dispute or disagreement as to the interpretation or application of the specific terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement. One of those specific terms is found in Section 25.10. And that specific term states the employer will provide a matching contribution to deferred compensation. That specific term goes on to set the amount of matching contribution that Ms. Shaber and her fellow union members who participate in the deferred compensation plan are entitled to. Now, the county also does not dispute that its public-facing website provides a summary of employee benefits that may be available. With respect to the deferred compensation benefit, the website directs union members like Ms. Shaber to their applicable collective bargaining agreement for information about their right to the deferred compensation match. Notably, that website summary says that an employee may be eligible for a match, but it is only the collective bargaining agreement that promises that Ramsey County will.
But Ms. Weinberg, respondent plaintiff disagrees with that, right? Respondent plaintiff has asserted a claim of breach of contract, not the CBA, but a different contract, right?
The complaint references only the website summary that I've just discussed as what constitutes the complaint, the contract. The complaint does not identify any other agreement that would constitute that contract.
But at the moment, we're not really evaluating the strength or the sort or the correctness of that claim. We're simply it's a claim, and the question is whether there's jurisdiction, or on the other hand, whether it should be arbitrated. But would you agree that in general, a plaintiff may choose which causes of action she wishes to bring. There, you know, any plaintiff could have a number of rights arising from a number of sources, perhaps, you know, A, B, C, D, E. And if the plaintiff wishes to bring only two claims, say B and C, and not assert her rights under A, D, and E, can't a plaintiff do that?
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, a plaintiff may decide which claims he or she wishes to bring. But here, the question is not necessarily about which claims she can bring. It's a question about which forum is appropriate in which to bring those claims.
Right. And so let's, could I turn your attention to, I know that you didn't brief them in this order, but I think it's useful to start with the question about who decides the issue of arbitrability. And if I think we're all going to look at 572B.06, paragraph B. And I think that the parties have focused their arguments on the exception clause, except in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, in which case an arbitrator shall decide. I think it's your position that this is a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement. Is that your position?
That is our position. And in fact, Ms. Shaver herself initially brought this complaint as a grievance.
Well, she initially pursued first few steps in the grievance procedure, but she went to district court and filed a complaint in a civil action alleging, not alleging a breach of the CBA, but rather alleging a breach of a different alleged contract as well as a breach of a common law duty. So why would this case that's pending in district court be considered a grievance arising under a CBA?
Well, first, Your Honor, I would like to point out that on a motion related to subject matter jurisdiction, the court is allowed to consider documents that are outside of the allegations in the complaint. It's the county's position that the only applicable contract is the collective bargaining.
Well, that's the county's position, but it's not the plaintiff's position. The plaintiff's position is, the plaintiff takes no position in this action, it seems, about her rights under the CBA. She's only asserting rights under a different alleged contract, I assume under a Pine River theory. And the question is whether that claim, just under, you know, understood as plaintiff has presented it, requires arbitration. And there's nothing, I assume there's nothing in that employer policy that talks about arbitration, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. The quote-unquote policy, again, which plaintiff points to, is simply that website summary, which does not have the essential terms to form a contract. It simply states that employees may be entitled to the benefit of a match for deferred compensation. And then that website summary says specifically as to union members that they need to refer to their collective bargaining agreement to understand their right to deferred compensation. So even accepting that that website summary formulates part of contract, which we believe it doesn't, but even accepting for the sake of argument that it does, the plain language of that quote unquote contract that plaintiff is pointing to takes her right back to that collective bargaining agreement.
I mean, I think, so is it your argument that you as the defendant may sort of reframe or reshape the issues presented in the case by your defense, perhaps by your answer, by arguments that you make subsequent to the complaint and that you've done so here? Is that your argument? In other words, even if the plaintiff has not invoked the CBA with a arbitration provision, you may do so as the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, we did at the district court bring an alternative motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. You know, obviously that is not subject to an immediate appeal like a question of subject matter jurisdiction. So that is not before the Court of Appeals today. But yes, the county has brought both the defense that the only contract applicable contract is the CBA, and the court needs to look to that contract to determine whether or not it has subject matter jurisdiction, but also the alternative argument, as I articulated, that plaintiff has failed to even plead the existence of the contract, which is based on, you know, the plain language of that website summary that is cited to in the complaint as forming the policy. That address your questions, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
And, you know, as I did briefly note, Ms. Shaver did initially bring her complaint through that grievance.
Yes? You were breaking up there for a minute. It happened twice, at least for me. I don't know if that happened for the other judges. Okay.
Well, hopefully that
just brief, just a little bit.
I did want to point out, you know, the problem that's created by respondent's actions in first bringing her claim through the grievance process, and then, you know, midstream, while the parties believed that they were still in grievance mediation, suddenly changing her mind and bringing her claims in district court. You know, that website summary, one can point to any number of summary benefits, which are also found in the collective bargaining agreement, vacation, sick leave, holidays, life insurance, leaves of absence, eligibility for tuition reimbursement, and the like. And if the district court's reasoning and Ms. Shaver's arguments are upheld, this would lead to significant confusion regarding this collective bargaining agreement and many others between the county and other unions, or even other public employers that use same or similar grievance provision and arbitration provisions. Really, accepting the argument is that a dispute maybe could be decided without reference to a collective bargaining agreement that speaks to the same term is a slippery slope towards rendering the entire grievance arbitration provision meaningless.
Counsel, could we talk about that grievance language and how it applies in this case? Under section 7.1, a grievance is defined as a dispute or disagreement as to the interpretation or application of the specific terms and conditions of this agreement. So what term is in dispute or would require interpretation?
The term is section 25.10 that states the employer will provide a match to deferred compensation, as I understand.
Right. I'm just, what language, though, would require interpreting?
I understand the complaint to challenge what it means to provide a match to deferred compensation and the process by which that match is paid, which would precisely be the interpretation or application of that specific term. And that is what is precisely in dispute here. Of course, the case law provides that these arbitration provisions should be broadly when assessing the scope of disputes that fall within their purview. You know, the county believes that there's no question that this specific term is in dispute, how the match must be followed. But even to the extent that there is some doubt, the arbitration provision here plainly touches upon that, or the agreement here plainly touches upon the question of deferred compensation, and therefore the arbitration provision in dispute should be interpreted broadly to encompass that specific.
So would your position regarding subject matter jurisdiction be the same if the putative class action was brought by a non-union employee? I mean, the issue here goes beyond just union employees, the issue raised by the complaint.
But, you know, that is a good question. Certainly at this stage in litigation, there has been no, not even class discovery, let alone class certification. So the obligation for the court is to only look at whether plaintiff herself states a claim. A non-union member may have a different claim that could be brought in district court, but that, you know, it's not uncommon for employers to have different agreements with different employees or different subsets of employees, be it union workers or non-unionized workers. And I don't precludes this plaintiff and her claims from being placed in the proper forum, which would be.
Ms. Weinberg, I have a question for you with respect to not only 572B.06, but actually 572B.07. And 572B.07 is motion to compel or stay arbitration. And is this really an issue of whether this is a motion to compel arbitration? Because it seems that the district court in its analysis essentially applied the two-part standard as to whether or not this is a motion to compel rather than a motion to dismiss.
The case law that analyzes under, whether an arbitration agreement, whether it's a motion to compel or a motion for subject matter jurisdiction, related subject matter jurisdiction on a arbitration provision, the courts essentially treat the analysis the same, and that the legal analysis is the same, and the end result is essentially a distinction without difference, because either dismisses for lack of subject matter jurisdiction or compels arbitration, the result is that the claimant must decide whether or not to proceed with the arbitration process. I see that I am out of time. Did that answer your question?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Before proceeding with respondent's arguments, I do want to take a moment to emphasize for the court what respondent actually asserts in this case. She seeks to hold appellate accountable for countywide promises made and obligations owed to all full-time employee participants, excuse me, whether they are in a union or not in a union.
But Ms. Bailey, if I could stop you there, we have to look at what her standing, we're at the stage. We don't look at what could be brought by all the other potential people.
That's correct, Your Honor. The inquiry is as to Ms. Shaber's right to bring these claims, or rather the court's right to hear the claims. But the proper framing of the claims makes clear that Ms. Shaber's claims don't arise under the collective bargaining agreement because they relate to a broader constituency than her union members. In other words, a non-unionized...
But Ms. Bailey, it sounds like you're getting back to... forcing us to look at a broader group of people, and we have to look at her. I have a question with respect to the putative contract that you are pointing to. That's a policy, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is there any underlying contract there that you can point to, or are you only pointing to the policy itself?
The policy is enforceable by contract under law. That is the law of the case. Currently, in this case, the district court decided that matter, and it's not.
But we review this issue de novo. What is the is there a contract between based on that supports that policy?
There is a contract. The employment policy is the contract under the case law looked at by the court, the lower court. There is an enforceable agreement here. There is definite enough terms to create a contract. And that question hasn't been appealed. I understand that this is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction and that is a de novo review, but the court has determined that a breach of contract claim has been made under a theory looking at an employment policy. We're not looking at a website, we're looking at and making pleading allegations as to an employment policy.
Well, let me, it looks like there certainly is, I think there's no dispute that there is an underlying contract here, collective bargaining agreement, the CBA, correct?
That is a contract between the union and the county. That is not the contract that is the underlying contract that forms the basis of Ms. Shaber's claims.
But Ms. Shaber is subject to the CBA, correct?
She is a union member. She is subject to a CBA.
Okay, and that's not in dispute. And under 572B.06, the validity of an agreement to arbitrate, subdivision B, talks about when a court can decide whether there's an agreement to arbitrate. and explicitly says, except in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, when an arbitrator shall decide. And from my perspective, it seems like the key question is who decides whether or not these claims fall under an arbitration agreement, whether it's a district court or an arbitrator. But it seems that 572B06, subdivision B, specifically says that that decision of whether this is whether it is a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, and there is a collective bargaining agreement here, must be decided in the first instance by an arbitrator.
Yes.
Isn't that correct?
Section 6B stands for the proposition that the default is the court decides. There is an exception, a carve out, where an arbitrator decides when there's a grievance that arises under a collective bargaining agreement. This is not a grievance. This is a
But there was a grievance that was brought. There was a grievance that was brought. And I mean, I understand that the issues have been framed differently, but it still seems that they tie explicitly to the language in Article 25, specifically 25.10, in terms of with respect to the language there. Let me ask you this question. I'm going to repeat the question that Judge Cochran asked, because I think it's an excellent one. What are the terms that are in dispute here? Aren't the terms in dispute the matching contribution? And what does matching contribution to deferred compensation mean?
The terms in dispute are the terms of the employment policy. And the best way for me to demonstrate that for you is with another question, which is if Ms. Shaver's union ceased to exist tomorrow, would she still have a contractual right to an employer match? And my answer to that question is she would, because Ramsey County provides all full-time employees who participate in the deferred compensation plan with an employer match.
Well, wait, let me stop you there. Do they provide every single employee, or is whether they actually will get it governed by the CBA? Because the CBA here says the employer will provide. So 25.10 has the mandatory language of will, which means shall. So this is what provides her the matching contribution to her deferred compensation, not the policy.
The policy summary tells us that all permanent, probationary, provisional, and unclassified employees who work at least 40 hours are eligible to earn these benefits.
Correct, are eligible. But does that mean that they are entitled to it?
If you're eligible, you're entitled to it. I don't understand that distinction. But
are there some employees that are not entitled to it?
In Ramsey County, the employees who are not entitled to it are temporary employees, and they are not entitled to it under the employment policy. So,
but the employment policy specifically points to and tells employees to look at your respective CBA.
They tell them to look at their CBA for the amount, because the amount is bargained. The amount is not an issue in this case. The question in this case is whether an employer match was ever properly provided to the employees, whether they're union employees or not union employees. But getting back to your Honor's question about whether the fact that a grievance has been brought here, the grievance is a red herring here. It was abandoned and a lawsuit was filed. Many of the cases respondent cites to involve factual circumstances where a plaintiff brings a grievance and then moves on to a court case to proceed to enforce a right outside of the collective bargaining agreement. That's the McDaniels case, the Bliss case, for example, the Farrell case. The Farrell plaintiff did initially seek out the grievance process, but abandoned it to assert common law claims in court. And it makes sense that they should be allowed to. There's no case law that says a plaintiff waives the right to go to court just because they initially seek out an informal grievance process before they've retained counsel. A rule that says as much would, I think, be counterproductive, because it may chill employees' use of the bargain or the grievance process, rather, if they have to somehow fear that pursuing that process initially is going to bar their access to court on matters that do not arise under the collective bargaining agreement.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge Reyes.
Okay. And I agree with you there. I don't think that a party certainly can bring claims that are separate and distinct and apart, but this seems to be so integrally tied to the CBA and the language of 25.10. It seems that in that case, then, that 572B.06 is invoked, which requires the arbitrator to decide. And I'm not saying that the arbitrator should decide one way or another, but it seems that the district court doesn't have the subject matter jurisdiction under that statute to make that initial determination of whether or not it actually applies. If the arbitrator decides, no, you know what, this is actually outside, then a separate lawsuit would be able to move forward. But if the arbitrator says, no, this is actually integrally tied to the CBA, I have jurisdiction to make this decision, so I'm going to move forward on it. It seems that it's the arbitrator who has to make that initial determination before anything else can move forward under the statute.
I disagree, Your Honor. This is not a grievance. If it was a grievance, it would be through the grievance process, and an arbitrator, yes, under that provision could decide, but it is not a grievance. I think that matters. That carve out contemplates scenarios where a union files a grievance and the employer refuses to engage in the arbitration process. Before the 2010 amendments, the union, if it wanted to move the process forward, would have to file a separate lawsuit and ask the court, and there's a few of these cases that appellate relies on in their brief, ask the court to compel arbitration. And that is not the situation here. I think, but don't know because there's no case law on it, that this provision was put in there so that the union doesn't have to go to court. It can go straight to the arbitrator to enforce its rights to proceed with arbitration. But in those circumstances, the question is not whether it goes to court or arbitration. The question is just whether it can proceed with arbitration. And my interpretation of 6B, I think, finds support with Section 7A, because what 7A tells us is what a court must do when a lawsuit is filed before it, and the party, the defendant, comes in and moves to compel arbitration, which appellant admitted here is the same as moving to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and the plaintiff opposes it. That scenario, that procedural posture, is where we're at in this case. In that instance, 7A tells us the court should summarily proceed with deciding the matter. And the district court here looked to 7A for authority to proceed with deciding the issues, relying on McDaniels and holding that the breach of employment policy claims and fiduciary duty claims brought by a respondent do not arise under the collective bargaining agreement.
But even if you look under 7A, the next sentence, based on what you had referred to, says, quote, unless the court finds that there is no enforceable agreement to arbitrate, it shall order the parties to arbitrate. So read in conjunction with 06B, that seems to, again, say this goes to the arbitrator to decide. I want to go to the subject matter jurisdiction issue, because opposing counsel was asked about whether respondent is the one who gets to decide what the issues are and how they're framed. It seems to me that the district court has to decide whether or not this actually is a claim that falls under whether or not it actually has subject matter jurisdiction to even hear this case in the first instance, or whether or not this is in fact a dispute arising under a CBA, in which case it has to send it back to an arbitrator to make that initial determination. So isn't that what the role of the district court is, to whenever subject matter jurisdiction is raised, to determine whether or not it can even hear the case in the first instance?
There's a lot there, Your Honor, but to your last question, I would agree with you. I do think that the Uniform Arbitration Act tells us that the default is the court, right? The default is the court, except with respect to a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, then an arbitrator shall decide. You already heard me tell you why I don't think this is a grievance. I agree with you. It doesn't, as to the second part of that phrase, it doesn't arise under the collective bargaining agreement. And you can really look to our analysis of the actual collective bargaining agreement language itself, and couple that with the McDaniel case that the district court relied on, which held that a claim that does not require interpretation of a collective bargaining agreement need not be exhausted a grievance procedure before bringing suit. And that line of cases, I think, kind of helps demonstrate that these claims relating to an employment policy do not arise under the collective bargaining agreement. To be clear,
Related to what you just said, though, if this claim that is being brought requires interpretation of the language, the employer will provide a matching contribution, does that then require arbitration? And if not, why not?
Good question. If we get to a point in this case where we're having to interpret the collective bargaining agreement, defendant or rather appellate might be engaging this motion. But we, at this point, based on the allegations we have in this case can be decided without ever looking at the collective bargaining agreement. The collective bargaining agreement is never cited in the amended complaint. And the right in the first instance to the match is bestowed upon all employees, all full-time employees, by the employment policies.
But is the term match defined? It's not defined in this website posting.
The match is defined in the collective deferred compensation agreement. And we do have two claims, right? We don't just have a breach of contract claim. We have a breach of fiduciary duty claim. Fiduciary duties are, you know, derived from common law, but are also informed by the obligations bestowed upon the county by the actual deferred compensation agreement itself. So in analyzing on what a match means, one of the places we're going to look is to that deferred compensation plan. And also just the ordinary meaning of the term match in, you know, common benefits parlance.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Perhaps one or two, Judge Cochran. Ms. Bailey, I think you just said something like, if this case goes forward and the CBA becomes relevant, then it might be different. I guess I sort of understood just from your complaint that it's not your intention to ever rely on that as your theory, but I guess, so maybe you're agreeing that if somehow you were to either amend your complaint, either with a motion or with your evidence, that then it's possible that, in other words, if you sought to use the CBA in some way, then it is possible at that point that the case perhaps should go to arbitration.
Yes, I accept that hypothetical possibility. There's no intentions by respondent to do that. We don't believe it's necessary to be able to sustain her claims, but I was just raising the hypothetical for the court.
I have a question for you about the statute, 0.06, paragraph B. If you have it in front of you, it might help follow my, because there's the first clause, and then there's a comma, and then there's the exception. The first clause has sort of two alternatives in the disjunction with or, whether an agreement to arbitrate exists, or whether a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. Is it possible that the second alternative of that first clause is triggered here?
Well, the question before this court is whether a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. That's the question of scope. And respondent maintains that her claims are outside of the scope of this case, of the bargaining agreement.
See, I read your brief, and I'll be more specific in my question. I read your brief to rely on the second clause, the beginning with the word except. Let me rephrase that. Appellant is arguing that the second clause should let the arbitrator decide arbitrability. Your counter argument is that this is not a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, which I understand. But for purpose of the court's analysis, for us to be thorough in analyzing how this statute applies to the case, is it possible that the right answer for us is found in the first clause, the second alternative to the first clause, in that the court shall decide whether a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate, and we would, I suppose, look to whether the employer policy on which you're relying has an agreement to arbitrate. I assume it doesn't, or obviously the CBA does have an agreement to arbitrate, but I'm not sure if there's a controversy there. I'm just wondering if this is another way to analyze the statute and whether you have any thoughts to guide the court.
Yes, Your Honor, I appreciate the clarification. I agree with you that when we're looking at 6B, in this instance, the first portion of the sentence, before the comma, is where we're looking. The court shall decide. There's two things a court can decide, which is whether an agreement to arbitrate exists, and a court can also decide whether a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. And that's what's before this court. We would urge that the question of whether a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate, and we assert that this controversy is not.
So just to clarify, to make sure I understand your argument, in your view, the language except in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, that only applies where a grievance has been filed, right?
It applies
something termed a grievance has been filed, as opposed to a complaint in district court.
Yes, I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize. It applies to enforce a grievance. And although a grievance was previously filed, that's not what's before the court. But with that clarification, I agree, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Bailey?
Judge Cochran, if I may?
Sure.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on your answer to Judge Johnson's question about potentially amending the complaint to look at the collective bargaining agreement. Isn't that something that would have to be done at some point because of the fact that the policy doesn't appear to be an agreement in and of itself? But even assuming it is, it refers to the collective bargaining agreement that does subject the parties here. So, I mean, it almost feels like this is an end around. Isn't this an end around to try to get away from and pretend that the CBA doesn't exist and that the Article 25.10 shouldn't be looked at or invoked when in fact it should be?
Your Honor, we lose, right? We lose our case if the court rules later that an employment, the employment policy is not a contract, right? So our claims rise and fall with that question. And the court has subject matter jurisdiction to answer that question, whether an enforceable contract exists pursuant to an employment policy. And we don't have to look to the collective bargaining agreement to create an enforceable contract. That is the allegations we're making at this early pleading stage. And we're not going to look at the collective bargaining agreement. The collective bargaining agreement acknowledges the existence of the match, which is provided by the employee policies, and then it sets the amount. The amount is not at issue. We can establish a damage under a breach of contract claim by just looking simply at Ms. Shaver's investment accounts and in demonstrating that no match was provided. And the payroll information is going to tell us exactly how much should have been provided and during what periods. So we never have to look at the collective bargaining agreement to prove Ms. Shaver's claims.
Any further questions from the panel? Thank you for your answers to those questions.
Thank you for your time.
Ms. Weinberg, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin by addressing respondents' assertion that a quote, proper framing of the claims puts this case in district court. Your Honors, I'm not aware of any law where a plaintiff can plead its way around the court's lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Policy that they continually point to is plaintiff to her collective bargaining agreement. This is why courts are able to examine materials and evidence outside of the record when considering subject matter jurisdiction.
Respondent's attorney argues that, I mean, you're correct, the policy refers to the CBA, but counsel for respondent argues that to make the contract claim that they've brought, the court will never have to refer to the CBA. So assuming that to be true, why doesn't the district court have subject matter jurisdiction?
If that were true, then it's unclear where the enforceable promise lies because the website policy only refers to the possibility of a deferred compensation benefit. It does not identify the specific amount of the matching benefit and the like. And so where are the essential terms to form a contract that would allow this claim to proceed? In that case, I would say there is not a claim to be had.
Doesn't that go to the underlying merits of the claim as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor, it would, but plaintiff does have an obligation at the outset to, you know, properly plead a complaint. And, you know, it was our position at the district court, and obviously that matter is not up on appeal, that plaintiff did not adequately plead a complaint because of this very deliberate attempt to evade pleading the collective bargaining agreement, which is the contract to which her employment is subject as a union member. That she is a union member is not disputed, and that the bargaining agreement applies to her employment. I think the issue has sort of become overcomplicated by this notion that plaintiff can, you know, somehow cobble together another contract when it is, you know, right before the court that this particular benefit is going to be set forth in the collective bargaining agreement, both in the policy cited to by respondent, as well as the collective bargaining agreement that was put before the court by Ramsey County. And, you know, the notion that claims can fall outside, the grievance process. I did want to talk a little bit about some of the cases that the district court and respondent are relying on for that notion, because I do think those cases actually provide a very clear bright line rule.
I ask you, Ms. Weinberg, to start with McDaniel and Farrell.
Yes, Your Honor. McDaniel was a retaliatory discharge claim under the Workers' Compensation Act. So that claim revolved around the interpretation and application of the statute related to retaliatory discharge. So those statutory claims are precisely the ones that fall outside of the collective bargaining agreement, because those are not the interpretation of a term or condition of an agreement, but an interpretation and application of a statute. Farrell v. Cross is wholly inapposite, Your Honor. That case actually involves claims by an employee directly against her coworkers in their individual capacity for defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. And while the acts occurred at work, they were actually unrelated to any term of a bargaining agreement. There, the district court incorrectly determined that a federal labor
Federal Railway Labor Relations statute preempted the common law claims that that plaintiff was bringing. That case really is not related to a dispute between an employee and the employer about over a term of a collective bargaining agreement. That was a claim brought directly against other individuals for common law claims. And so that claim, I think, is wholly inapposite. I see that I'm about to run out of time. So there are no more questions. I would simply respectfully request that the court find that the collective bargaining agreement and its arbitration provisions remove the district court's jurisdiction over this claim and reverse the district court's decision and dismiss.
There are any further questions from the panel? All right, well, thank you to both counsel for your helpful